Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 8th of June, these are our main stories. The Women's Football World Cup opens in France, and in the first match, the hosts beat South Korea 4-0. NASA is opening up the International Space Station for tourists with deep pockets. And who is responsible for the pollution in South Korean cities? Also in this podcast, where weddings are arranged according to the availability of water tankers, and how scientists discovered three new species of frog on the island of New Guinea.
It was a little strange frog, and it was a tree frog, but it had this strange little sort of proboscis on its nose, this little sort of spike sticking out of its nose. And so that's how we found one of these new species of frog.
Plus why an American sportswoman has changed her nationality to Chinese. But first, it's been a good day for football in France. The 8th Women's World Cup is officially underway, and the host French team opened the tournament with a resounding 4-0 victory over South Korea. For years, women's football has struggled to get the same attention that the men's game enjoys, a pattern the sports governing body FIFA is hoping to change. Already, the tournament is turning heads, as one Paris fan said.
Some things are changing. We talk about it more. I don't even know if I was ever aware that a Women's World Cup takes place, but this year I learned about it.
Our sports news reporter Alex Capstick was at the Parc des Princes in Paris to report on the opening action.
Well, the match itself was very one-sided, but they won't bother the French at all because they're the hosts. They wanted to put on a great display for their fans who came here in their thousands. They packed out the Parc des Princes, 45,000 sell-out. They were noisy, they were enjoying themselves, and they were enjoying what they were watching on the pitch because the French team were absolutely terrific. They won by 4-0. They were far too good for South Korea, who were simply outclassed. And this French team, you know, they've always been good individually, technically very good, but they don't always play as a team, and they've often frozen on the big stage. Well, there was none of that tonight. They were brilliant. That 4-0 win, thoroughly deserved. And the other sides in this tournament, the 23 other teams, including South Korea, who were well beaten, they'll be looking at the French and thinking, this is a team that's going to be difficult to stop. They were very, very good tonight.
So always nice for the host nation when they do well in the opening game. But you're actually saying that maybe France are ones to watch?
I do. I think they are. I mean, after that display today, they're going to be a team that other sides will fear. I mean, everyone knows they're good. They're one of the favourites to win this tournament. They're playing on home soil. And the noise inside the stadium today, we must talk about that because that was a factor. The home fans here, I wasn't sure what to expect because in Paris over the past few days, there hasn't seemed to be that much excitement about the World Cup, but they turned up here today, they filled the stadium and they made a racket. They sang the national anthem, La Marseillaise. That was loud, that was vibrant, that was raucous. And then they got into the match right behind their team. You know, and that's something that other teams won't have here at this competition, that home crowd. And it really buoyed them on and they were great. And they had their celebrations afterwards, actually, with the fans. Was something to behold as well. They really enjoyed having that backing from the home fans, and they lived up to their billing of being one of the favourites in this tournament. And this display, OK, South Korea, not the best team. They will have sterner tests, but they really laid down a marker with this performance today.
More generally, does this World Cup finally put women's football on the map?
Well, that's what people are hoping for. We've had, of course, World Cups before. This is the 8th edition, but none of them have been organised by FIFA this way. They've put a lot of money into this. They've invested in the women's game. They want it to bear comparison with the men's competition. So the facilities the ladies have got in France are the same as what the men would get in terms of their hotels and their training facilities and all that sort of stuff. The prize money, not as good yet as the men. It's way below. But the action on the pitch, and that's the important thing, that is getting better. That's in improving and improving. And as we saw from the French today, it's of a high quality, a high technical quality. That's sometimes been a factor that people have said, look, it's not quite as good as the men's game. It's not as fast. It's not as technically as good. But actually, it is a different game. But watching this tonight with the crowd behind them, it was very impressive.
Alex Capstick in Paris. South Korea is one of the most polluted countries in the world. 18,000 people a year are thought to die from related illnesses. But there's a debate around the source of the toxic smog. The BBC team was the only international broadcaster allowed on a special monitoring flight as scientists in Seoul try to find the origin of the pollution. Laura Bicker has this report.
When the levels of pollution get really high, this is the kind of alarm you hear on your phone. Looking around me now, I can see people wearing their face masks to try to avoid breathing in the toxic air. On some days, you can hardly see the building next to you because the air is so shrouded in smog. For decades, there's been a dispute about where this comes from. Ask anyone in the street and some politicians, they'll tell you it comes from China. But environmentalists say the solution does lie much closer to home. You ready? You sure? Sure?
Sure.
You ready? All that is really certain for now is that at its worst, some have to battle to breathe. Among them is 4-year-old Koo Hyun-woo. He's shy in front of me at first, but eventually he has to get up out of bed for his medication. He suffers from various breathing problems, made worse by the air pollution. He spent his young life in and out of hospital. In fact, his mum tells me she used to watch him sleep to keep him alive. The family have moved as far out of Seoul as they can, but still, he can't go outside without a mask. His family are part of a growing protest movement. Whether this air is from China or not, they want the government to do more to deal with the problem. So is air from China really choking South Korea's children? Officials are taking to the skies over the Yellow Sea to find out. The instruments start to show readings just as we climb above the peninsula. From the window, I glimpse some of South Korea's power plants. Coal-fired stations produce over 40% of electricity here. High car emissions are also thought to contribute to the smog. But there are other readings.
Red line is a black carbon number concentration. This point is near the inland area.
An Jun-young, researcher at the Ministry of Environment here in South Korea, sits beside me on the plane. He shows me the levels of carcinogens in the air, cancer-causing carcinogens, according to the World Health Organization.
The further west we fly, the higher the readings that they're getting on all of these scientific instruments. In other words, the closer that this plane gets to China, the more polluted the air becomes. And that's the latest band of pollution is making its way to Seoul in just a few hours' time.
So is this new enemy in the air from within or without? We await the scientists' findings. The government has said it will tackle domestic issues such as car emissions and coal use over the next few years. But Koo Hyun-woo's family believe drastic action is needed now to help save the health of South Korea's next generation.
Laura Bicker in Seoul. It may not be as comfortable as the Royal Penthouse Suite at the President Wilson Hotel in Geneva, but you'll get it for less than half the price per night. I'm talking about the International Space Station, which will be opened up for tourism by NASA. Robin Gattens, the Deputy Director of the ISS, made the announcement.
We're enabling private astronaut missions to the International Space Station. NASA will support up to 2 short-duration private astronaut missions per year to the International Space Station beginning as early as 2020. These missions will be privately funded, dedicated commercial space flights allowing approved commercial activities to be conducted on board the station.
So how is this going to work? A question for our science correspondent, Jonathan Amos.
Well, you'll need a lot of money, for starters. They are talking about charging you $35,000 a night, about that. That will include, you know, kind of use of the facilities, including the toilet, I should add. It's very important. But extra to that would be the cost of carriage. And you would go up with one of the new American companies that have been asked by NASA to produce capsules to take you to and from the space station. This is SpaceX and Boeing. And that'll likely cost you about $60 million.
Ah, so that's the expensive bit.
That's the expensive bit. I was quite impressed, actually, with the data charges. They're only about $50 per gigabyte. So if you take some selfies up there and you want to send them back, that won't cost you too much.
Presumably, we're not yet talking about the average man or woman in the street going up there. Who will be the customers?
Well, we've seen in the past a number of very rich individuals go to the space station. They went on the Russian side with the Russians. The Russians made several opportunities available with the Soyuz craft that took people up for, you know, a matter of weeks, and then they came back down. Now the Americans are starting to set their sights on going back to the moon. Now, you may have heard them talk about this Project Artemis in recent weeks. So we had a Project Apollo in the 1960s, 1970s. They're now talking about going back to the moon. They're calling it Project Artemis. They want to do it by 2024. It's going to be very expensive. Costs about $3 to $4 billion a year. NASA is going to step back. It wants to step back, save some cash, and then spend that on going to the moon.
So who takes the ultimate decision as to who the passengers are? Is it the Americans, the Europeans, the Russians?
The space station is a partnership. Okay, there are partners. There's obviously the United States, there's Russia, there's Europe, there's Japan, and there's also Canada. So they all have to be involved. There is an international treaty that governs the use of the International Space Station. But in reality, the Americans are the big players, along with the Russians. And if they make the case to their partners that, for example, a European astronaut will not be endangered in any way, that will not be disadvantaged in any way, then they can make the case to do this kind of thing. And, you know, we talk about commercializing the space station. Some of the customers will be those other space agencies. So for at the moment, Europe, because of its partnership, gets 8% opportunity to use the space station. It may want to purchase extra by saying to a Boeing or NASA, whatever it is, can we buy an additional seat on one of these new spacecraft to take up another of our astronauts to the space station? So, you know, there may be a little internal market taking place here as well.
Jonathan Amos. Homophobic and illegal. That's how Andy Street, the mayor of the West Midlands in central England, has described protests against lessons incorporating same-sex relationships and transgender issues at a primary school in Birmingham. Many of the protesters are Muslims. Here's our correspondent, Seema Kotecha.
Andy Street told the BBC he'd been personally affected by what had been happening in Birmingham. The mayor, who is gay himself, said that it was the first time he had realised that homosexuality was an issue in the city. Mr. Street called the protests homophobic, offensive and hurtful. He condemned some of the leaflets and banners being used by the demonstrators.
Your first reaction is disbelief, actually. You just can't credit that it could be said in this day and age. You look at what's being said and it's really upsetting, but it is actually ultimately homophobic, and that is illegal and it has to stop now.
But Mr. Street's call for an end to the demonstrations appears to have fallen on deaf ears. Parents and campaigners gathered today near Anderton Park Primary School to continue their demonstrations. An injunction has banned them from protesting outside the school gates. Despite this ruling, they continue to believe that teaching primary school children about LGBT relationships is inappropriate. And next week they will attempt to have the injunction lifted.
Seema Kotecha. If you're interested in ideas, how people think and how things get created, the BBC World Service has the perfect podcast for you. It's called In the Studio, and every week it takes you inside the minds of the world's most inventive people, following them as they create something new. If you hop over to In the Studio right now, you'll find a really diverse library of musicians, artists and creators, like the fashion designer making a costume for Bjork, the golf course designer creating coastal symphonies of wind and sand, and the Olympic skaters combining the work of choreographers and costume designers with physical skill in the pursuit of gold. That's In the Studio from the BBC World Service. Just search for In the Studio wherever you found this podcast. Hindu villagers in parts of the western Indian state of Gujarat are now planning weddings based on the availability of water tankers rather than the traditional method of consulting an astrologer. The reason? A severe drought in the region. More from our South Asia editor Anbarasan Etarajan.
It is a huge problem for some parts of Gujarat state, especially those border states with the Pakistan, which is a desert area, where they say many of the lakes and reservoirs in that particular area have dried up. It has never happened in the past. This year particularly, the summer rains were missing. And if you look into Indian weddings, it is a huge affair for any family, even a small family in a rural area. Dozens of guests will turn up. So for a Hindu wedding, they will consult an astrologer to fix or a priest to fix an auspicious date where they make calculations based on the stars' movement. So what people used to do is to fix these things in advance so that relatives from faraway places can come to these weddings. Now it is based on whether the water tankers are available or not because they're so desperate for water. If you're going to invite dozens of guests, you need to have water so that you can prepare dinner. They're going to stay there for 2 or 3 days. So instead of auspicious days, now they're going for whether water tankers are available on those days or not because even these water tanks are in demand.
And the suggestion is that the underlying cause is climate change, man-made climate change.
10 years ago, what the scientists are saying that Indian reservoirs in many states was about 20% during summer months. Now it is reduced by a half. The municipal water, or what you call the corporation water, comes in taps. It comes now once in 5 days, once in 10 days. So they're entirely reliant on these water tankers. And where do they get water from? They go to the suburban areas, they drill bore wells, or they go deep into the wells. They are sucking the water out of the ground. And that is adding to, you know, water depletion, the water table going further down.
Can the authorities do something about this?
People are talking about creating more reservoirs, like, for example, desilt many of the lakes in surrounding many towns or the reservoirs, and also urging people not to deplete the underground water and asking people to use the water judiciously, not to waste water. But the main issue is the population is growing and the need for water is growing, and the climate change is affecting because India is not getting enough monsoon rains. For example, the monsoon was supposed to start, the southwest monsoon, on the 1st of June, which starts almost in the southern part of India. It hasn't started yet, and they're hoping that this weekend it will start.
Anbarasan Etarajan. Nigeria's oldest prisoner has been released at the age of 100. Celestine Egbenuche was granted a state pardon after a campaign for his release. Our Africa editor Mary Harper reports.
Celestine Egbenuche was on death row for plotting to kidnap and murder a man over a land dispute. He was sentenced at the age of 82. His son Paul, who was jailed on the same charge, cared for his ailing father in prison. They shared a cell with other death row inmates, and both men protested their innocence. Paul Egbenuche said his father was like a child and was unaware of his surroundings. He had to bathe, dress and feed him. Mr. Egbenuche's daughter, Chisum, said she was the happiest person on earth following the release of her father. But she said the family didn't have the means to look after him and didn't have a room where he could stay. Nigeria's jails are notorious for overcrowding and the poor treatment of prisoners. There are more than 2,000 people on death row in the country, but executions are rarely carried out.
Mary Harper. Frogs that can glide. Frogs that look like the brightest jewels. The diversity in amphibians on the island of New Guinea is rich and far from completely catalogued. And now, Australian researchers have discovered 3 new species of frog in mountains stretching across the border between Indonesia and Papua New Guinea. Dan Damon spoke to Dr. Paul Oliver, one of those who made these discoveries.
It was streaming down with rain. It was incredibly wet spot. It rained every day. Our clothes turned green, my hat turned green with mould. And so on this particular occasion, of course, what we're doing is we're hiding from the rain in our camp. And just one of the local guys, basically, he sort of looked down on our food store, and there was a little strange frog hopping on it. And it was a tree frog, but it had this strange little sort of proboscis on its nose, this little sort of spike sticking out of its nose. And so that's how we found one of these new species of frog. It didn't take, you can effectively say it found us.
Well, I was going to say, you don't think the frog went back to its mates and said, I've just discovered this amazing creature.
You could say we were certainly the first humans this frog was seen, had it ever seen, because we were in a part of the world that basically no one had ever been to. It was completely unexplored. So it was kind of a mutual discovery experience, I guess.
And the others, tell us about the other two new frogs.
So one of them is a gliding frog. It's a moderately large frog, about 6 or 7 centimetres long, and it's got this sort of bright purplish webbing, both on its feet but also on its hands. And what it does, and some of its relatives do, is it uses that. So it lives high in the trees, and if they're scared or if they want to move to a different branch, instead of climbing down and moving across, they actually just jump out into the air. And they spread their arms out and they spread their fingers and toes out, and then they use that there's enough surface area there that they can actually control their descent. So they're parachuting frogs. So that's one of them. We call it Latoria pterodactyla, which means winged fingers. And the other frog is a much smaller frog. We call it Latoria vivisimia, which means cheeky monkey. Because we know where it lives. We've been back there multiple times, and we've only ever seen the one of them. So we think they're probably up in the trees laughing at us because we can't find them.
What does this tell us about evolution, for example? Why are these frogs so diverse in this environment in Papua New Guinea?
Well, I guess these particular frogs, they contribute to building a broader story. Like, a lot of researchers and a number of my colleagues have been working on frog diversity in New Guinea, and it's turning out to be truly remarkable. So I live in Australia. We've got about 250 species of frogs in Australia. New Guinea, this island made up of two countries, is much smaller than Australia. But we've got, so far we know of almost twice as many frogs in New Guinea, 450. But we also know there's lots more that remain undescribed. And I guess it's like New Guinea's just like this consciously designed fun park for frogs. It's got mountains. It's incredibly wet. So these lineages of frogs that have got to New Guinea, they've diversified to an incredible degree.
And that's because the habitat has been largely untouched, and you're worried that that may not last.
Oh, certainly. Like, New Guinea at the moment, compared to other parts of Southeast Asia and other areas nearby, it's got a lot more of its original forest than those areas. But of course, the pressures which have affected those forests elsewhere in Southeast Asia, palm oil plantation, logging, clearing for agriculture and other sorts of farming, those same pressures are starting to build up and grow in New Guinea, both in the Indonesian part of New Guinea and also in the eastern half, Papua New Guinea. Certainly there's opportunities there. There's incredible diversity to preserve. And I guess now the challenge is linking with the people of New Guinea, working with the people of New Guinea to try and find ways that, you know, they can develop their economy, but try and do that in a way that maintains this wonderful biological diversity.
Dr. Paul Oliver, curator of vertebrates at the Queensland Museum in Australia. We began this podcast on the football pitch and we end it on the ski slopes. Well, figuratively. Eileen Gu is just 15 years old, but she's already represented the United States at freestyle ski competitions around the world, including a victory at the 2019 World Cup.
I really can't describe how happy I am right now, honestly. Like, it's insane. It's insane. It's been a dream since I was little, and I'm actually here. It's just all so unreal.
Now, with the 2022 Winter Olympics in her sights, Ms. Gu has left her home country for her mother's native China. Our China media analyst, Kerry Allen, has the latest.
Today she announced that she has received Chinese citizenship, and China doesn't recognise dual citizenship. So in order to do this, she's had to abandon her US citizenship.
So does this increase her chances of getting a place on an Olympic team, getting a gold medal ultimately, I guess?
Yes, it does. She's recognised that she could be a very strong competitor as an athlete.
But less internal competition in China, I guess, is what you're saying.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely, yeah.
So a big win for Chinese athletics, potentially.
Absolutely, but not only for athletics, I mean, for wider politics as a whole. With the US trade dispute going on at the moment, China's happy to promote lots of stories about people recognising that China is just as powerful a country as the US. And there have been a lot of stories in the past about people defecting from China to go and live in countries like the US. But China's saying that this shows that she recognises that it's a country that is just as safe and can offer her as many opportunities.
Is it all gain here?
Well, it could be problematic for her because China's not really got that many connections with other countries in terms of, she travels abroad, she's going to have to secure visas for a lot of places. There'll be a lot of restrictions for her in terms of the media environment with China being tightly controlled. I mean, there are some people who suspect that she might compete and then afterwards return to US citizenship and reapply. So there is some cynicism within China.
What about sponsorship? Because a lot of the sportswear giants are American companies.
Yes, exactly. This will be a difficulty for her leaving the US because there's opportunities there. But at the same time, because she's half Chinese and half American and she's got blonde hair, for a lot of Chinese sponsorship companies, they would be leaping at the chance to get her on side. A lot of Chinese users are going beyond the Chinese firewall to access platforms like Instagram and to leave her messages. She's had thousands of messages from people saying, "Welcome home."
Kerry Allen. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.
Real Protection means a home security system that's designed for you and your family. With 24/7 monitoring from 18,000 employees and connection to first responders, your property and the ones you love can feel safe and secure. ADT is great for every lifestyle. Whether you're at home or on the go, you can control everything from the ADT app or just with the sound of your voice. Visit ADT.com/podcast to learn more about how ADT can design and install a secure smart home for you and your family.